like to thank you know, the perimeter and to for organizing this. And I'm Pascal. I'm going to be talking to you about the subhilo mass function in scale-free cosmology. And I hope to motivate my talk because a lot of simulations show that the subhilo mass function is almost self-similar, like almost scale-free. So the question is it truly scale-free? I figure this is probably a simple way of sort of understanding if it is. So I'll give a quick outline because everybody here sort of knows about structure formation, you know, lambda CDM and sort of wind models and so on. And I'll mainly focus on sort of the difficulty with doing these numerical experiments and, you know, why we want to do these numerical experiments and on our results. So, you know, you've got for this structure formation, right, we've got this basic picture of, let me get the hockey stick. Of, you know, you start off with some sort of initial conditions, the inflationary otherwise, k to the 1 or 1 minus something, the, you know, basic simple things. You add in some, you know, physics in terms of when the modes of, enter the horizon start to evolve. So there's some transfer function based on when these modes enter the horizon, transforming the initial power spectrum, which was initially some sort of, you know, pure power law, into something else. And in general, this is at the very, very small k, like k to, sorry, very, very large k, k to infinity, very small scales. You tend to get something that goes as sort of k to the minus 3, but that's basically at infinity. There's usually a k3 log k transformation. But before we get there, there's always usually you have this exponential dampening from free streaming and dampening scales that involves sort of the actual cold dark matter WIMP physics, right? You stick in some mass scale, some cross section. So these guys are obviously going to be the bottom of the hierarchy. And, you know, obviously, you can mess around with the actual particular scale, but I mean, in general, you know, people quote 10 to the minus 6, so that gives you 10 to the 18 scales, mass scales that you want to know the subhalo mass function over if you want to know what the galaxy is like right down to the small scales, right? So this is obviously a big number. It's going to be tricky to do. And once we have these density perturbations, you know, we stick them in, we watch the, you know, the stuff collapse and form objects, they form a hierarchy, and eventually, you know, if you're lucky, you can throw in some baryonic physics and we can really see the universe that we get, right? But obviously, I'm going to be focusing on sort of just this region here and seeing what we get out of the higher. Now, the reason for you know, knowing the dark matter to the small scales, I mean, everybody sort of knows here. It's I mean, you'd love to know it just maybe from a pure physical perspective, but detection is an important thing. It's very clumpy. If they're very concentrated and they're nearby, maybe the smallest things will leave an imprint that we could actually detect, like people have discussed this. If it's basically smooth, then it's great for direct detection. But if you also have a lot of streams, then that's even better for direct detection, right? You get some sort of velocity difference that you can use when you're looking at these nuclear recoil experiments. Anyway, so you guys sort of know what's going on here. Now, how do we actually do this, right? So in most cases, you stick in this in some initial conditions. And this can obviously vary sort of what the small scale result is. So if you stick in sort of an n equals 1 or n equals, let's say, 0.95, in terms of the initial spectral index, it'll sort of alter the very, very small scales, what the effective power spectrum slope is at its scales. But anyway, you start off with this. You go to this slightly quasi-linear regime, right? You use some sort of initial conditions generator, which usually involves a Zilbovich approximation or second-order Lagrangian perturbation theory. And you can't just start off with a power spectrum, do everything, and stick it in a simulation. It's discrete. You have to start off with the simulation somehow. So you got to use some initial conditions. And this actually has an influence, right? These will leave numerical artifacts because they're never perfect. But then, you know, you'd love to be able to do analytically, you know, go from here to here to, you know, gravitational clustering, but it's very difficult. So you run simulations. And you'd love to know this, right, you know, to maybe 10 to the 8 factors in scale and 10 to the 24 factors in mass, right? Maybe do gigaparsecs and then go down to, you know, smaller than parsec scales. But, you know, we can't really do this. Like, how do you get around doing this dynamical range, right? If you want to know maybe what the internal structure of a halo is. Well, what might save you is self-similarity, right? If the subhalo mass function is truly self-similar, then we don't really need to model it all the way down. We can actually guess the number, right, which is sort of where 10 to the 15, you know, wimpy objects comes from. But the question is it always self-similar? Right, we'd love to know this. If it's perfectly self-similar, then we can get maybe really good estimates as to what the number might be. So that's the question, right? And the picture, at least for larger scales, is, yeah, you can grab a, you know, cluster halo, and this is the BLXA simulation. These are, I believe this is just the log of the density. It's log of density squared projected, but you get the general idea that these sort of small little bound clumps look very similar to each other. So it does look like they're self-similar, at least for these scales, right? Oh yeah, that's what you get if you, you know, grab a couple of halos, elliptical galaxies, or in this case, the Milky Way-like halo. So this is 10 to the 13, 10 to the 12 comparison. You look at the cumulative subhalo mass function or the differential. It's basically an Ice power law, minus 1. And it does appear that the amplitude is like varies, right? So stuff that forms earlier will tend to have more substructure, but the distribution doesn't seem to change that much, right? So maybe we can save ourselves. But okay, there we are. But if you look at sort of just, I mean, naively, right? So if we want to look at self-similar, does it look self-similar when we go to the smallest scales, right? So these very, very high redshift, small-scale simulations of a couple of parsecs. If it was purely self-similar, I mean, you could almost expect, I could say, I could look at one and I could look at the other, and they look the same. The sort of the internal properties are roughly the same. So yeah, it's probably the subhill mass function is self-similar. But there, this is the log of the density squared. This is also the log of the density squared. And obviously, it doesn't quite look there. So there's a possibility maybe you would expect a variation in the subhill mass function. You don't know, right? But maybe it's there. So it's tricky, right? So that's what that's what I really like to get at with these scale-free simulations that I'm running. I don't know what the exact scale of this is, right? But the density contrast here, we know, is several orders of scale. I think this is also maybe order 5, order 7.
Well, the point we're trying to make on the right hand, though, is more that the contrast is
reduced. I know. That's my point, right? So
the whole number.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. Right? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if you look from a naive fashion, right? If I just naively said, is it self-similar? Maybe a while, maybe it isn't, right? So that's all I'm saying. It's just caution, right?
But the n here is different, right? The Kostka and slope here is quite different. So why would you expect it to be self-similar?
No, I'm saying if the power spectrum is very different, I'm talking about like looking at sort of the density contrast in terms of subhalos, right? Or just, I realize it's very different, right? I'm not saying that I would expect it to be self-similar. I'm just saying that if it was self-similar, right? If the let's say the halo internal properties aren't drastically governed by the spectral index, then I mean it's not true, right? But if it wasn't drastically governed by the spectral index, like the concentration, if let's say in the accretion process, right? Not necessarily the rate of accretion, but how the accretion process behaves, right? How tidal stripping occurs, is completely unaffected by the spectral index, right? Then
most of what else would it depend on?
How would you quantify the degree of self-similarity?
I'm not saying that I can quantify it directly. I'm just asking the question, right? So I'm just saying that, that's why I'm just putting this question out, right? I don't know if I can quantify the difference, the difference from self-similarity of looking at the internal structure of this object, right, which forms at a larger scale with a much different spectral index. And just say and quantify. Okay, so this is, I'm not too sure unless you know how to quantify the difference from self-similarity. I'm just asking the question, right? Right. So that's all I'm saying. Right? Is it going to work? Right? If it does, then maybe you don't have to worry. You don't have to build a much much bigger simulation to model necessarily the subhill population. Right. As Mike Fulton pointed out, right? So these are, if you look at the distribution of subhill, right? It's a function of sort of, this is mass fraction, this is the differential, right? So the number of objects in a given bin. And you look at generally what's often recorded, which is sort of minus 2-ish in terms of the math, the dependence on mass, right? It does look like from what you get out of these objects that the subhills are basically, in terms of the population, right? The distribution mass, this is the same, right? But as I said, for steep indices and also for small simulations, right? They're pretty small simulations. They're high redshift simulations, and it looks slightly different. So you maybe wonder if it's a small volume. You always worry about small volumes. So it you always ask the question: so could we trust this? I mean, maybe it's correct, right? But you have to check this, right? That's what I'm just saying. We really do need to check this. I mean, you can get estimates based on this of 10 to the 15, but if it's a slight change in the index, right? You're going over so many mass scales. So if you go, let's say, minus 1, right, in terms of the cumulative distribution, right, so if I look at some mass interval, then yeah, maybe I would get 10 to 15 in terms of the normalization for a Milky Way halo. But if it's minus 0.8, that makes a pretty drastic difference over the mass scales you're talking about. It's a large mass range, right? So that's why I'm just trying to caution. If it's perfectly self-similar, then this quantity is robust. But if it's not, if there's slight deviations just due to in terms of spectral index, we might reduce or maybe increase this number. So if you look at, this is sort of what you were talking about, the spectral index, right? If you look at the spectral index at these scales, right? So I've got here the variance and the mass variance, which are both useful measures of nonlinearity, right? So they're both useful measure of nonlinearity. I've got it from, minus 3 to 7 inverse megaparsecs, 10 to the 21, 10 to the minus 9. the general idea is here, you maybe see an issue, right? Because you hear you, if you look at the nonlinearity, right? Obviously, if this is a measure of the nonlinearity, I mean, this is just an arbitrary scale over here. But if this is, let's say, nonlinear, then the scale much, much larger here, like, you know, maybe four orders of magnitude, is almost nonlinear. So you have structure formation forming at all scales. And so maybe, you know, you'd expect a slight imprint, at least in terms of, let's say, the internal properties based on accretion and mergers on the subhalo population, just because you've got this formation rate at all scales. And if you look at, you know, sort of a nice cartoon picture of the power spectrum, right? So here I've got the power spectrum, just it's a power law. If you look at the density perturbations, right, I mean, you sort of know implicitly what's going on. If you go to steep indices, right, you're pretty much dominated by the larger scale modes. So when you run a simulation, and it's basically in this, you know, very steep regime, you can seriously bias your sort of result, right? Because, I mean, you're missing some large scale power that's very, very important. So we've got these issues. So if we look at the, and just to reiterate the point, right, if you look at the effective index, right, sort of the slope of the power spectrum and the mass variance that define these effective indices, the general idea is that at very small scales and at very small masses, these effective indices, these are going to -3. And the relative formation time is basically roughly, you know, sort of n+3/6. So again, you'd expect maybe it's going to leave maybe some imprint, but the question is how much, right? Maybe it just reduces the number, but the actual distribution remains unchanged. So that's possible.
So
10 to the 9, well, so, I mean, this is based on, this is a W map with a, like, 0.951.
It's -2.7 or for arc axis.
So yeah, so for around here, it's around -2.7. Galaxy scales, you're looking at maybe -2.2, 2.1, right? And that's the idea, right? So, and the key point, obviously, is it's tricky to, you know, directly compare. I'm going to mention this, but I mean, scale-free, obviously, it's just going to be like that for us. Here you've got a running index, so. But so another issue is for these, at least for scale-free, but also for running indices, is this n=-3 problem. Right? Do you want to run simulation where you have somewhat nonlinear scale at some particular scale, but you want your largest modes to be linear, and you also don't want to be missing a large amount of nonlinearity outside of your box. So there's finite volume effects that come into play. Right? You're missing power bigger than some scale. And if you look at, for at least a scale-free simulation, the sort of missing power that you're not including because of your finite volume will go roughly as sort of the variance at your largest mode, so the nonlinearity of your largest box mode, over the n=+3. And just for this sort of presentation, I just figured I'll fix this to around 0.4. And this has been used by Smith et al. And a couple others to sort of quantify how good their simulation is. So this is another measure of maybe how good your simulation is. You're not missing that much, missing a large-scale power. It's tricky, right? I mean, the idea is for scale-free, you'd look at self-similarity, right? You know sort of how it behaves. You'd expect maybe some self-similar evolution. But if I make sure that I'm not missing too much nonlinearity at my largest scales, at the outputs I analyze, I'm probably not disastrously off in terms of the statistics, right? So I'm not missing that large amount of power, so I'm not biasing my results that much. And based on that, you could say, well, I want my simulation to be quite nonlinear at some particular scale, and I don't want to miss much power, right? So this is what I've got over here, just a ratio of sort of the missing power and how nonlinear I want the Nyquist scale to be. I just chose a particular scale. And based on that, you can actually come up with requirements for the number of particles you would need to properly simulate this. And this is just, you know, to emphasize the point. So I've got here 0 to -3, and there's 10 to the 24 particles required to simulate, you know, sort of maybe 2.6 if you wanted something really stringent, right? If you wanted the ideal simulation where you're not missing power, it becomes almost impossible to do these scale-free simulations. It's really tricky.
Large modes with your high-resolution particles. I mean, you can have multi-mass.
Yeah, so you can have multi-mass stuff, right? But that just sort of beefs up the effective index, right? So I mean, if you go to smaller scales, right, all I'm saying is that the very small, I'm comparing the Nyquist scale, right? So the effective particle number based on the Nyquist scale was a sample. And so if you have, you know, several layers, and let's say you have multi-particle systems, right? Your bottom, your smallest particles, that's what I'm talking about, the Nyquist scale there. So that's the effective particle number of your box, right? And that, I mean, you'll still sample those, right? They still need to see that large scale power. For steep indices, at least, definitely, right? Because you're going to be screwing the result. So it can be really tricky to do this stuff. But you want to get as close as you can, as good as you can. And so, you know, if you relax the conditions, you can obviously push these lines of requirements a little off to the side. So it can become slightly easier to do, but it's still really tricky, right? It always blows up as sort of n plus 3. We can also come up with sort of minimum resolution constraints in terms of the requirements for the halo. Right? You want halos, if you're going to look at substructure, you want halos with a bunch of particles in it, right? Otherwise, you're just going to wash out these subhalos. You come up with other constraints. And the idea is that it's just, in general, it becomes very tricky to do very steep scale-free simulations. And it also can be very tricky if you're sort of, let's say you're doing a running index simulation, but you're only sampling a small region over here, and you've got an effective index here. Right? The missing variance isn't going to be as bad, but you still could be, you know, off. Right? So that's what I'm trying to get across. Right? If you look at the sort of VLACTA simulation, right, it covers an index sort of roughly in this range in terms of the halos that it looks at. Right? So somewhere between sort of minus 2.7 to maybe, you know, 2.2 in terms of the Milky Way size, right? So, and it's quite likely that this is, I mean, it's probably not suffering any systematic effects, at least if they are, in terms of, let's say, the use of the second order Lagrangian perturbation to start your theory, start your simulation, or the Zeldovich, they're pretty small. But for any really, really steep run, right, if it's very, very small, there's always sort of the worry, maybe it's not going to get it right. That's all I'm trying to get across. You have to be very careful when you're doing these really steep simulations and very, very small sizes. And so, you know, yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, emphasize the point that it can be really, really bad at these steep indices, right? You're going up to huge, huge numbers. It's not possible to do. It's not practical. And if you're wondering how bad it can be in terms of just sort of the internal properties of halos and formation and structure that you see, I just figured, well, I'll throw in, I just tried for the hell of it, right? So one of these minus 2.9 simulations. And all I've got here, minus 2.9, pure power law, 512 cubed. I'm nowhere near good enough to be able to do this. And I just figured I'd make my simulation worse by putting, you know, cutoffs in the power and just checking out what you see in terms of the density of a region, logarithmic density, and sort of objects found. Right? So this is just friends of friends, just to see what halos I find. I found a halo in the first one, right? So I just color-coded. I figured I'd search for all the particles in my other simulation that initially belonged to this one. And the initial conditions are exactly the same, except I removed some power. It just shows you, right? So you can get these, you know, disastrous logs. It's the same output time. I'm drastically changing my result. It's just to emphasize the point that it can be really tricky to do these steep indices, and you can get them drastically wrong at any given time if you. Yeah. So the idea is, I initially looked at one part. No, not all the particles in box. I just found all the particles belonging to one particular halo around 10. Yeah. So halo, same particles plotted here. But found with color-coded with friends of friends in this particular simulation. This is all at the same time, but they're three different simulations. And here I've got the logarithmic density of the particles found in this halo, right? And I've also sort of plotted where what the logarithmic density of the halos of sort of the particles around the halos that I found here, right? So these guys, almost all these particles in this halo, were comprised of these several halos in this simulation where I removed large-scale power. Yeah, exactly. I know. I realize it's very simple, right? This is just a throw slide. I mean, obviously, you just know it can be terribly, terribly wrong, right? So here I'm trying to run scale-free simulations, and the reason why is I figured I can choose a couple of scale-free simulations, and you can vary the spectral index, right? So this is the idea: vary the spectral index drastically, and see if the internal properties, or at least the internal distribution of subhalos, doesn't vary, right? If it doesn't vary, then, I mean, yes, the amplitude might vary, but if the distribution doesn't vary, then perhaps we're sort of saved by self-similarity. We can just do a galaxy to a certain scale, and if we're not worried necessarily about caustics or very, very sort of the very, very fine structure of the subhalos, then we can just go and go, okay, we have this guy, we get the amplitude for a Milky Way halo, right, the number of subhalos found, we sort of know how the distribution behaves, we can just go down to the smallest scales and we say we find 10 to 14, 10 to 15. And one of the reasons why scale-free also is you sort of know how your simulation behaves. You can also get a better estimate of whether it's good. Right? It isn't just a matter of convergence. If it's self-similar, there's no scale. There's only one scale in the simulation, and that's the nonlinear scale. So you can quantify how good your simulation is by looking at, let's say, the self-similar evolution of a power spectrum. I don't actually have those plots there because my supervisor is working on that. He's got the plots, and he hasn't emailed me exactly what it is. But, I mean, this is very self-similar, and this is not terribly badly behaved. I can't quantify necessarily exactly how good this is. It appears to be reasonably self-similar. So there's no finite effect from the largest mode playing into the sort of evolution of these simulations. And so the idea is, yeah, sort of separate merger physics and accretion physics from the initial conditions to see if there's any effect on the initial conditions on sort of the, you know, subhalo distribution. And I mean, other people have done it to look at sort of concentration parameters to see if the concentration parameter is a function of spectral index. And it apparently is. Right? So the steeper the index, the less concentrated these halos appear to be. But some of their very steep indices simulations I wouldn't necessarily trust, but they've run minus 0.5, minus 1.5, minus 2.25, and they're probably trustworthy. They've run minus 2.5 and minus 2.75 scale-free simulations, but I worry about the effects of the closer to the -3, the less concentrated the halo becomes, right? So that may influence sort of how much of maybe a boost signal you get, right? Here you get a lot more clumpy simulations here. Obviously, for steeper indices, it's a lot more filamentary. The density contrast isn't as great, right? Now, so I've got my simulations, and I want to find some halos. And, you know, obviously, everybody knows you find halos. You know, so 3D friends of friends find them, a simple way of finding halos. With for subhalos, I was using a 60 friends of friends finder. And the idea is here that, it'd be nice to sort of vary this velocity parameter. So this criteria, I can obviously here vary two parameters and check to see what objects I find. And I figured for the most part that I'd actually just leave this linking length unchanged. So I'm trying to find regions that are just overdense by so much. I mean, that's what usually this is sort of density information. This is, you know, velocity information. But I was varying the velocity parameter to see if there was an effect on the subhalo mass function based on just trying to separate these guys in phase space. And in my case, once I had my candidate subhalos, I actually did I did unbind these. Right? So there's a lot of stuff that you know, for friends of friends, you have to worry about, right? If you find a friends of friends object, there's no guarantee that it's balanced. So you always want to sort of unbind. And here, just to emphasize the point, so this is an n equals minus one simulation. These are both basically three sigma peaks, right? So I want to compare the same sigma peaks. I've got logarithmic density. And here, obviously, I mean, as people point out constantly, it's obviously easier to see this. And they have well-defined boundaries here, right? The subhalos are very easy to see, very easy to distinguish, and they have well-defined boundaries. So here is just the movies of sort of how the three, you know, if you look, just use density information, if you start using velocity information, sort of what the halos you find in these objects, the subhalos you find in these. So I'll just try to speed it up a little bit. And obviously for the steep indices, you need that phase-based information. It can drastically alter results. So you have to worry, right? Are you choosing the appropriate velocity parameter when you're trying to find your subhalos? That's something it may seem sort of, okay, I choose the right velocity parameter, so I get sort of the right subhalo mass function. But when you're considering sort of looking at these things physically for boosts and so on, if they're not very well separated in velocity space, then you might as well consider them almost sort of one object, right? So you can get a lot more substructure as you vary the velocity parameter. And so this is sort of what I found, right? So I've got here, I'm averaging over actually several peaks. So this isn't just for one halo. I haven't looked at the variation based on peak height, because I'm still assuming that the distribution remains unchanged in terms of peak height. So there's possibility that there's some variation in terms of peak height, right? But I'm averaging over rare peaks, so two peaks, two sigma peaks, or three sigma peaks at a particular redshift for these simulations. And what you find is as you vary the velocity parameter, so I was just looking to see if there's a region here, you can see some numerical turnover, because I can't find objects bigger than this, because I'm choosing too tight a constraint in terms of the velocity parameter. You can see this. So here, I've got the sort of the standard sort of m equals minus one. This is the cumulative. And it's pretty, you know, it's almost there, but not quite. It's almost minus one, but not quite. But that's sort of the standard result, right? Most people don't find exactly minus one. But for n equals minus 2.5, you can see I can sort of drastically alter the slope of this subhalo mass function. And it's just because these things don't have very well-defined boundaries, right? It's not like it's a nice isolated little clump that has a nice isolated well-defined boundary. They have still, you know, not fantastically distinct boundaries even in phase space. So it's very tricky to say. But in general, if you look at these, right, also I should probably point out, this is a lot more unbound candidates. Right? I can find a bunch of candidates, but a lot of this stuff is sort of not well-bound, whereas this has a lot of bound candidates. It's a very spurious effects. So if you look at the sort of power law of the subhalo mass function, right, for n equals minus 1, I've sort of outlined sort of a broad range where most people may find, depending on how they find subhalos, what they find subhalos in terms of the spectral index here. So elliptical galaxy, the Milky Way halo, sort of these are the index of those particular objects. And you find that for the most part, n equals minus 1, regardless of how you change that velocity parameter, because they got nice well-defined boundaries, the slope is still minus 1, or roughly minus 1, I mean minus 0.9 essentially. And This is true even if you do just density information. You actually reduce the number of objects you find, but because they're so well-defined, they have very well-defined boundaries, the slope is still roughly there. But if you look at steeper indices, because they have less well-defined boundaries, I'm obviously drastically altering the slope, right? So I probably wouldn't trust this. But even here, it's not quite self-similar, but as I said, it's almost there. So there's a possibility. I would love to do much, much larger simulations. But there is a hint that you do lose some of that perfect self-similarity as you go to steeper indices. Right? So it's, and in terms of real subhalos for like detection and so on, because the slight changes in sort of how you separate these in phase space drastically results in the number, changes the number and the distribution that you find, then it could be an issue, right? So I'll sort of skip over this. It's just looking at the triaxiality of these objects and sort of the morphology. They tend to be more triaxial, obviously, as you get to steeper indices. And I think the big thing here is just, right, it's very tricky to do these things, but it's a good idea to check this, right? If you can do scale-free simulations and we can use sort of -1 and -2, there's a massive change in spectral index, right? And a massive change in relative formation time. So it's useful to check this just to see if it's still scale-free, but it's very tricky to do. And you really do have to sort of, you can find a lot of spurious artifacts and numerical artifacts when you're finding a subhalo, so it's a good idea to unbind. I mean, it's very tricky if you have, you know, 500,000 particles and you want to make sure you run a proper unbinding routine. But in general, it does appear that self-similarity, you can't naively save you, right? It's possible that it's there's a slight change in the slope, right? And it's I'd love to, as I said, we're going to do a couple more runs of scale-free stuff just to see if there's any variation with spectral index, like the, but you need pretty large simulations to get the statistics. But I think maybe the main point is that they're morphologically, and they have a very poorly defined boundary. So in terms of the number, right, if you can separate these things very well in phase space, then you might, you know, say, okay, the distribution basically remains unchanged. But in terms of just, you know, getting a boost signal, you want density contrast. You don't necessarily want a nice separation in velocity space. I mean, it might be useful if they're very well separated in velocity space. Otherwise, you know, they're pretty loosely bound. They're pretty triaxial. They have very poorly distinct boundaries. So it's possible that, you know, if you stick in baryonic matter, and then, you know, a tidal field on these, it might actually, you know, become unbound. It might be actually result in a lot of streams, which is very useful for direct detection. Right? So there's a possibility, right? That I'm just trying to get, you know, caution that the use of sort of 10 to the 15, because small changes in slope, given the wide range of mass scales, can drastically reduce the number of objects you see. And that's my presentation. Yep.